I will say C. I don't know that, of course. We originally found most of what I'm going to be saying today numerically. I mean, Chris, it all started because Chris said, can you just calculate this? So I did on Mathematica. And as you'll be aware, if you look at a fiducial vector, the components look horrible. And if you calculate the overlap phases, they look horrible. They look horrible if you do it numerically. They look horrible even if you do it analytically. You get these great long expressions involving roots and roots of roots and blah. So I calculated the eigenvalues of this matrix, as which I'm going to talk about in due course. And I was assuming they were going to be horrible. And to my amazement, they weren't. They were really simple, nice. So I thought, well, that's just a fluke. Well, I first of all thought perhaps I made a mistake, but I hadn't. So I thought then maybe it's just a fluke. So I calculated some other examples, and they were still really nice. And then we calculated lots of other things, all just numerically. And it just, we just kept coming up with these really nice numbers and these intriguing relations. I should say that we've proved everything now. So I'm not just talking about numerical speculation. I'm talking about provable properties of these things. And I don't know, I was very excited for about a month because I thought, wow, you know, maybe this is the key to everything. This is going to lead to a proof. And it didn't.
Proving existence. There is more in heaven and earth.
Yeah, sure.
So there is.
But you know, I mean, I'd really like to prove existence. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Not the key to everything. Well, one shouldn't call it everything.
The key to a lot. Anyway, something I'd like to do. quite a lot. As I say, it hasn't yet. I still want to talk about it because I continue to feel, well, maybe I've just missed something. And maybe, in fact, one of you guys will notice something that we didn't think of. So I think it's worth saying. So in any case, I think the results are quite pretty. And I don't quite know where they go, but I feel they ought to go somewhere. Or at least there's a reasonable chance they go somewhere. Okay. Chris was talking about these things, so which we call triple products. So the pi r's are the projectors. If you've got a sick, you've got d squared vectors like that, and pi r is just the corresponding projection operator. So I'm talking about those things, and I personally am going to use that notation. So the CRST is this rather than just the real part of it. And I'm also going to talk about this object. Which is the Gram matrix you get from those vectors with a factor of 1 over d in front. And I guess the basic philosophy is this. okay, Seeks are a very enigmatic sort of object in the sense that lots of people have tried for a long time to try and prove their existence and have so far failed. Something that is useful to do sometimes when you have that sort of problem in mathematics is to sort of turn this problem you can't solve round and try and turn it into some other problem that perhaps looks quite different. So if you approach these from objects from the direction of a seek, you think of the fundamental things as being these vectors and these objects as being sort of derivatives. So you've got a sort of tree with the psi r vectors at the bottom, and then two branches coming off like that. I want to slightly change that and think what would happen if you took that as primary or that as primary. So perhaps to replace it by a sort of circular logical structure, in which maybe you start with this or you start with that and regard that as the primary object. And I think that is quite an interesting thing to do, as I hope you'll agree when I've finished. I'm going to start with the Gram matrix. Which, if these vectors are coming from a seek, that's going to equal 1 over d if r equals s, and 1 over d root d plus 1 e to the I theta rs if r is not equal to s, where the theta rs's are a set of phases. And certainly in the Weyl-Heisenberg case, if you know those phases, you can easily reconstruct the seek. You can do that in general, in fact. I mean, that's kind of what I'm going to start by saying. Suppose you're just given these phases and you want to know, do these come from a seek? Question one. And two, can I construct the seek? How do I construct it just given the phases? But I'm not assuming Weyl-Heisenberg. I'm just assuming it's, well, I'm not making any assumptions at all. I'm just asking whether it's a seek, Weyl-Heisenberg or not. Perhaps it has no group covariance property. I'm just making no further assumptions at all. How can you tell? Well, if the psi r's do come from a seek, then you know that this is equal to d times the identity matrix. So you've got a set of phases, you form this G matrix. So I'm not making the assumption it comes, okay, sorry, I am making the assumption. It's coming from a seek. So if you form, suppose you calculate G squared. So the matrix elements of that are 1 over D squared. And because of this, that's equal to 1 over d psi r psi s, which of course is just grs. So g squared equals g. It's obviously a hermitian, so it is in fact a projection operator. It's to make it a projection operator that I stuck that 1 over d in front. What's the dimensionality of the space it projects onto? Well, trace of G is just this. And that is equal to D. So it's a rank D projection matrix. Okay, and that's fairly trivial. Now, I was assuming that these things do come from a seek, so suppose we turn it round. Suppose we just take any set of angles. Theta RS with the obvious anti-symmetry property, because we want, yeah. Suppose we've just got a set of angles like that. We form the corresponding G matrix, which is 1 over d e to the I theta 1, 2 over d root d plus 1, et cetera, et cetera. So we just form a matrix from these angles in that way. There's no assumption that it's coming from a set of vectors, that it's a Gram matrix or anything like that. And we calculate, because of that property, it's guaranteed to be hermitian. suppose we find that it is in fact a rank D projector. So G squared equals G and trace G equals D. Then it actually follows just from that property that this is in fact the Gram matrix coming from a set of seek vectors, as you can quite easily see. The fact that it's a projection matrix means that, right, at this stage, I just want to introduce a bit of notation. A ket that I write like that belongs to a d-dimensional space. Of course, big G is a d squared by d squared matrix. So it's living in a d squared, acting on a d squared dimensional space. And for that reason, because I'm going to be talking about d and d squared dimensional matrices all the time, I think it's convenient to introduce a notation. A ket belonging to the d dimensional space that the psi r's live in, I'll write in the usual way. If it belongs to d squared dimensional space, I'll sort of double it up just to indicate, so you can always tell which space you're talking about. And in order to write it as a matrix, I'll sort of choose a standard basis, so I can write it like this. So those things are the standard basis. Now, I'm going to suppose that we've actually found that this thing is a d-dimensional projector. So we know we can, in fact, write it like this. Okay. Where these things are orthonormal. Now, define a set of d squared vectors in the d dimensional space. In this way, define psi r a to equal r psi a. So from your d vectors in d squared dimensional space, you can obviously define a set of d squared vectors in d dimensional space in that way. And then you find that it's easy to see from the properties that these things form a seek, because you have this psi r psi s equals sigma a and then we use that relation. This which is just GRS. Oh, sorry, I should have stuck in a root D there. The right way around. Sorry, which way? D, yes, that's right. So you have a D there. And so that's equal to 1 if R equals S and E to the I theta RS over root D plus 1 if R is not equal to S. And so they do define a seek. So you've got an equivalence between having a seek in the d-dimensional space and having this very special type of rank d projector in the big d-squared dimensional space. Now, there's something quite interesting about that, because it's obvious that if you have a seek and a unitary operator, and you replace these vectors with these, that gives you a second seek. But of course, acting on the psi r's with a unitary operator u leaves the overlaps unchanged. So you've got a single d-dimensional subspace in your big d-squared dimensional space, corresponding not just to one seek, but to a whole infinite family of them, which I think is quite nice, really, because in a way, this invariance under unitary transformations, it's just giving you more of the same. It's just some endless repetitions of the same thing. And if instead of focusing on the individual seeks, you focus on this d-dimensional subspace, the big d-squared space, you're replacing this whole family of seeks with just a single subspace. Very different type of object, too. Instead of sort of symplexes in density matrix space, you just got a flat d-dimensional subspace, something linear. There's something else that's quite nice about it, because for each infinite family of unitarily equivalent seeks, you have one d-dimensional subspace. If you had another infinite family of d-dimensional, of another infinite family of unitarily equivalent seeks, you would, of course, have a different d-dimensional subspace. But of course, it is true that any two d-dimensional subspaces in your big d-squared dimensional space can be transformed onto each other by a unitary operator acting not on this, I think I'm going to call this the small space, and this the big space, just to save breath. So any two d-dimensional subspaces defining as a seek, you must be able to transform one into the other with a unitary operator acting on the big space. And in fact, if you were interested in characterizing the set of all seeks, which I think is quite an interesting question, what are all the seeks you can define in a particular dimension? What can you say about them? How many different, well, there's all sorts of interesting questions. So, I mean, most of the work that's been done on this problem has involved seeks which are covariant under the Weyl-Heisenberg group. But there are some cases, known cases of seeks that are covariant under other groups. Marcus Brassel has described some. And of course, you might wonder if there are seeks that don't have a group covariance property at all. And I think this object perhaps gives you a sort of initial way of getting some sort of handle on this problem. I have to say, I spent quite a lot of time trying to do this, and I failed. But I think it's worth making the point, because maybe somebody else could make something of it. I mean, this is a workshop, so I guess the idea as much as anything is to exchange ideas. And I think it's useful to exchange ideas you couldn't yourself do anything with, because somebody else might be able to. I mean, for instance, I wondered a lot whether you could prove that every seek has a group covariance property. And I thought maybe I could use this to prove that, and I couldn't. But I don't know, I still feel that's an interesting question, and I still feel this is perhaps a useful starting point if you want to answer it. Okay, so, you know, sorry?
Two seeks which are not related by a unitary in small space, but which still have the same G metric, right?
Yes, I think it is conceivable, yes. No, I think it isn't. Mm-hmm. If you've got the same, this unitary, you see, when you choose Okay, you've got this kind of duality between these vectors and these vectors, the size and the size.
You say that back transformation is the unique way, more or less, to get a seek out of the G matrix.
I wouldn't want to say it's unique, but it's the way I'm using, the particular mapping I'm using. The point about it is that if you make a unitary transformation on the small space, that corresponds to choosing a different basis for your d-dimensional subspace. Conversely, if you take any two bases here, they define two unitarily equivalent seeks. So I think if your two seeks did correspond to the same space, certainly under this mapping.
And this mapping is clear, right? But I mean, there could, in principle, still be another way of going from a G matrix to seeks in small space, which is not necessarily that way. Or maybe.
Well, you could doubtless define another. I'm actually not quite sure. I would need to give it a little bit of thought. Okay.
For
all
instance,
right.
Two seeks that are related by an anti-unitary, but not a unitary.
Yeah.
Might preserve this G.
No, the anti-unitary mapping will generally give you, would correspond to taking the complex conjugate of the components of these vectors. So it will, in general, give you a different subspace.
Are you going to tell us about the? Well, we know that there are some real vectors in there that are preserved.
Yeah. Okay. Before I mainly wanted to talk about triple products. I've probably got on to the main. I haven't got on to the main product. But I do just want to say one other thing, which I don't know what to make of it, but it's quite nice. Well, I think it's quite nice. And this involves specializing for the Weyl-Heisenberg case. So up to now, what I was saying was completely general.
Marcus, could you take a second to figure out what's making the noise? What is rubbing on you?
I think it's the board.
No, it happens when you walk back and forth.
That's like electronic. Some electronic.
I think it's my feet being amplified. Probably.
I mean, is it simply rubbing on your shirt? Doesn't look like it, but.
Not too bad, is it?
Yeah, that helps.
Maybe
put
it
in your pants pocket.
Well, I could clip it on, maybe. Is that good?
Yeah. Try putting it in your pants pocket instead of your trousers.
Okay.
Another one? What about or messing with connection then?
I think it's fine now. Okay, we have to just leave it there. Please, Horace, continue.
Okay. yes, specialized to the Weyl-Heisenberg case. So I'm going to define the displacement operators. It's important how you choose the phases of these things. So I think the neatest way to do it. So here P is a vector. I mean, I'm assuming everybody's kind of familiar with this. And it doesn't really matter if anyone isn't, because nothing much hangs on it. It is important how you choose the phases here. So there's different ways of defining putting in the phase. I'm choosing this particular phase.
Could you just define tau?
Oh, tau is equal to minus e to the pi I over d. So that may seem a slightly complicated way of doing it, but it's got various nice consequences. For instance, if you take the product, I mean, my main reason for preferring that is you get this neat way of forming the product of two displacement operators, where that's a symplectic form. So it kind of respects the symplectic structure in a way that's sort of neat. And you also have this. So I sort of personally prefer that way of doing it. What I'm going to say is actually specific to this case, and in fact it's an argument for saying this is the best way of defining it. Because when I originally found this, I told Steve about it, and Steve went away and tried it on his computer. But he didn't choose that same phase convention, and so he failed to get the result. He just got a mess, I think. So it's very sensitive to phases. So this is assuming a particular choice of phase. And then we form this matrix. And because I'm now talking about Weyl-Heisenberg, instead of R and S, I'll write P and Q. And that, if it's a Weyl-Heisenberg seek, that will be a rank D projector. Suppose we take the conjugate of it. That's also a rank D projector. I mean, if you take the conjugate of a projection operator, you get another projection operator. Now, normally, if you just take an arbitrary projection operator, there's no particular relation between the projector and its conjugate, because if we just, in general, have an arbitrary projector like this, so I'm not talking about just about projectors in general. So if you take the conjugate, you're basically taking, replacing the E's with the vectors whose components are the conjugates of those. And there's no reason why you'd expect any particular relationship between those two subspaces. They're both defining D-dimensional spaces, or whatever the dimension of the projector is. But in general, you'd expect there not to be any particularly nice connection. In the case of a Weyl-Heisenberg seek, there is. It turns out that if you take that property, you get this. So G star G is equal to G G star. They commute. That's not guaranteed in general either. And they commute and they give you a rank one projector. That's a normalized vector. So what it's saying is that the G space and the G star space they overlap, they intersect in a single one-dimensional space, and then they've got two D minus one dimensional complements which are orthogonal to each other. Another nice thing about this is that if you're in the standard basis, okay, I should put P, that's real. So it's not just any old vector, but the components are actually real. There's quite a nice expression for it, but whether you're in even or odd dimensions. But if you're specifically in odd dimensions, where the Wigner function is defined, it turns out that, so this is in odd dimensions only, this thing is equal to root dw minus a half P, where a half means the modular inverse of 2. The number such that 2 times it gives you 1. So if we're in dimension 5, a half would equal 3. So in other words, we've got this rather nice relation. Well, I think it's nice. I mean, it's nice, but I don't know what to do with it. But it does seem to me to be pretty.
But did you say what W was?
The Wigner function. The discrete Wigner function. Yes, yes.
So,
I don't know what that means. And maybe it's not very exciting at all, but it just seemed pretty to me. And I think it's worth mentioning.
Question. How much of this argument depends, excuse me, depends on the fact that this is the complex conjugation? So if you would replace it by a, say, Galois conjugation, supposing that your field, if it's a field, it might have some...
Yeah, no, the Galois conjugates are interesting. I haven't
is
looked
it true
at that.
Is it true in that case?
I think it might. That's a very interesting question, but I don't know the answer. These things do transform in a nice way on the Galois transformations.
Yeah, it should go through.
But I haven't actually investigated this particular thing.
Okay.
So just to clarify, are you imagining that this vector space is defined over a different field extension?
Yeah, I was wondering that, I mean, in many cases you work, so the entrance of the matrix coefficients of the PLVMs, they live in some field extension.
Okay, so you're imagining a minimal field extension and there are multiple Galois conjugations that you could define on that.
Right.
And you're asking, okay.
Because all the examples that are known so far that I know of, they have some nice, say.
Yeah, no, they do. I mean, I got kind
nice
of...
and not nice because it get large to write down.
Well,
but
it's nice, but it's incredibly hard work, or at least I found. Perhaps that's just my incompetence, but I sort of struggled away for days with dimension 5.
Okay.
In
particular, it would be interesting if this property that they overlap in one vector only, and the rest is orthogonal. If that holds still true, if it's a Galois or a morphism.
I think that is an interesting question to ask. I absolutely agree, but I haven't answered it. At least I haven't answered it. Okay. So I'll now get on to triple products.
You can just, don't bother erasing, just pull down your blackboard.
Yeah.
It takes a little hard game.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay. Okay, so I'll now get on to triple products, which we define to be these things. So in terms of the pi matrices, they're this. In terms of the psi vectors, that. You can see immediately from that the C's are invariant when you replace psi r with a unitary translate of it. And they're also invariant when you replace psi r with a phase times it. You'd normally think of that as being a completely trivial thing to do. And it is if you're working in the small space. But you can see from this example that when you're considering the properties of the G matrix in the big, acting on the big space, the phases actually make a difference. And in fact, acting with a unitary doesn't change the D-dimensional subspace. But rephasing these things does. It actually corresponds to a non-trivial unitary operation in the big D squared dimensional space. So these spaces are not always as trivial as they look at first glance. But the nice thing about the C's is the phases will cancel out, because everywhere you've got a psi r, a bra, you've got a corresponding ket, so they will cancel. So that's both unitarily and phase invariant. And that also, in some way, you know, that makes it a particularly nice object in a way. Again, if you know the C's, you can easily work back to the C. So these are enough. The G matrix and the corresponding D-dimensional subspace gives you one way of defining the C, or rather giving you one way of defining a whole infinite family of C's. This gives you a way of defining an even bigger infinite family. And you can easily, well, obviously you can't reconstruct the unique seat because you've lost a lot of information. That's the whole point. The whole family is collapsing onto the one object. But you can easily construct a representative if you want to. Or any representative. You can easily characterize the family. So these things contain full information. Well, okay, except the full information about the family. And they're very interesting objects. I mean, Chris has, in his talk, you know, was talking about how they're very interesting from the point of view of thinking directly in terms of probability distributions. they're really nice from other points of view too. They're nice mathematically. Now, what I want to do is consider the matrix C. With elements so CRST is just this. In other words, we keep the first index fixed and that gives us a matrix. And this, we're actually going to get a family of D squared of these matrices. Now, the nice thing is these matrices are really nice because you might ask, what is their eigenvalue decomposition? And it's this. So I'm putting in double lines and arrows because I'm working in the D squared dimensional space again. Where that is a rank D minus one projector. And that is a normalized vector. So in other words, CR has one eigenvalue equal to 2D over D plus one. D minus one eigenvalues equal to D over D plus one, and D squared minus D eigenvalues equal to zero. So it's not a very pretty structure. This was the thing that originally that Chris and I found last summer and sort of set us off on this path. Because Chris just said, what are the eigenvalues of that matrix? So I said, okay. And I was expecting them to be horrible because the CRSTs are disgusting objects to look at. And I was just amazed. You know? Very simple. And so, you know, we started to explore it further. Numerically, originally. I mean, this is not just a numerical guess. We can prove that. The MR vector has a very, very simple structure. I'm not sure I can remember the normalization. I think it's this. Something. I'm not sure about the constant. But anyway, it's something like that. So you can write it straight down. So these are kind of boring. And all the interesting stuff is living in those. So those QRs actually contain complete information about the C. And if you knew what they were, you could write the C down. And okay, before I was considering a single rank D projector. Now we've got a family of D squared rank D minus one projectors. So it's a somewhat different point of view. They're different objects. They're very tasty objects. to me, they are, anyway. Okay. Okay, now, I'm going to tell you a few things about them. How much longer have I got? When did I start?
You started about 15 minutes later.
Okay, so I've got 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, I may not need 20 minutes. Okay, so split them into real and imaginary parts. I'm kind of tacitly assuming all the time a particular basis. The basis that's assumed by this. So I can define real and imaginary parts. R I'm going to define to be Q plus Q star, but it's twice the real part. And J is minus Q star. So it's twice the imaginary part. Now, what can we say about those? Well, at this stage, I want to point out there's a connection with Lie algebras. If I take the projectors, you've got d squared of those, and they're a basis. Well, for the Lie algebra, Ud, or if you want to think in terms of complex components, GL, CD. It is D first and C second, but it doesn't matter. That's kind of equivalent. It just depends on whether you take real complex combinations of them. And there is a connection in these things and the adjoint representation of this to the algebra, quite an important connection. It's quite easy to confirm. Okay. So you define it. I will skip the derivation. I'll just write down the answer. If you can define the adjoint representation on this Lie algebra. So if I've got any two matrices, L and M, belonging to UD, then you define the adjoint representative of L acting on M simply to be the commutator.
Sorry, is that a commutator or an anti-commutator?
Commutator.
Okay.
So suppose we act, we do this, it turns out that that is simply this. So the JR matrices, you can actually basically say that the adjoint, ST. So the J matrices are in fact the adjoint representatives of the pi R matrices regarding them as elements of the Lie algebra UD. Now, in Lie algebra theory, there is an object called the Killing form, which is defined to be, you take the trace, you want the Killing, let me call it K, so it's a bilinear form, and K of L and N is defined to be this. So that's giving you an inner product on the Lie algebra, which is actually plays a major role in Lie algebra theory. So I don't know, when I started to realize this, I got excited because I thought perhaps I could use structure theory of Lie algebras to prove Sikh existence. I couldn't, but I don't know, maybe somebody else can. There is certainly some sort of a connection here. Okay, and you can prove, in the case of this Lie algebra, that that's equal to 2D trace LM minus 2 trace L trace M. In other words, you can calculate the trace of the product of two adjoint representatives in terms of the trace of the products of the underlying matrices.
Last thing, 2 trace L, trace M?
Trace adjoint L, adjoint M.
In the bottom right, 2
trace. Trace L, trace M. I mean, it's quite an elementary result, really. And it's in all the algebra books. Okay. Now, that, of course, means that if we want to calculate this thing, that just amounts to calculating the Killing form, and we can express it in terms of the trace of the pi r's minus twice that And you end up with...
Sorry, Marcus, I didn't follow that step. I mean, the J's are these...
The J's I've defined to be
the imaginary
parts of the cubes, or at least twice the imaginary parts.
Right, so it's not obvious to me. I mean, those cues act on a much larger space, so why is it obvious that it's... Is it because we're using...
So then I pointed out that basically you take the commutator of pi r and pi s and you go through the algebra, which I haven't bothered to do. I'm just telling you, you find that you get that.
I see this formula. Yeah, okay.
Which means that the J matrix is the adjoint representative of...
Okay, I had just forgotten that last line, and then it follows from this. Okay.
And then I was using this well-known connection between the killing form and the traces of the actual elements of the Lie group itself. But then you can easily calculate this. And I can't remember what you get. Hang on, let me look at my crib sheet. I've lost it.
Well, that's one over e plus one.
Oh, here we are. Right. 2 over d plus 1 d squared delta rs minus 1, I think.
Plus 1.
No, minus 1. Yeah, minus 1. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So we can easily calculate the trace of 2 of them. In particular, trace jr squared is going to be 2 into d minus 1. Now that is a very interesting fact, because I think I can clean all this off. Because jr is qr minus qr star. So jr squared is qr squared plus qr star squared minus qr star minus qr star qr. But these things are projectors. So we have that. So now if we take the trace, we get trace of QR, which is D minus 1, because it's a rank D minus 1 projector. Trace of QR star, also D minus 1. And then minus twice that. Trace of that. But we know that trace of gr squared is 2d minus 1. So that implies this is 0. Now the fact that those are projectors actually means that the product is 0. In other words, you remember that with the ground matrix condition, we had GG star being a one-dimensional projector. Here, equals 0. Q and Q star are actually orthogonal projectors. Which again, you just don't normally expect this if you write down an arbitrary projector. It has to be a very special kind of projector indeed for it to have that property.
There's no phase convention here, like.
And it's not depending on phases at all. And it's not depending on Weyl Heisenberg. It's completely general. It's true for any seat at all. Okay. The fact that Q and Q star are orthogonal projectors immediately gives us a whole lot of other stuff for free. Because. we can now say that JR squared is just this. So it's RR. We can also see that RR squared is RR. And in fact, RR, R is a rank 2D minus 1 projection. JR has D minus 1 eigenvalues equal to plus 1, D minus 1 eigenvalues equal to minus 1, and D squared minus 2D minus 2 eigenvalues equal to 0. So we've got the complete eigenvalue structure of the J's and R's. Also, what's quite nice is that QR is a half RR plus JR. But in view of that relationship, we can write the Q's in terms of the J's. And the Q's give us the full seq. I mean, they give, so that means the J's do. The J's say everything there is to say about the family of seqs. So we've got a sort of connection between a seq and a very special kind of way of choosing a basis for the adjoint representation of UD. Now, there's a whole lot of identities we first of all found numerically and then proved. I could sort of actually cover the board with the things, but I'm not sure. Well, I think they're nice. But I think you'd sort of just feel kind of overwhelmed and not very interested. I don't know. I mean, if you look at a book on Bessel functions, you sort of see about sort of 10 pages of identities. And the first time you ever look at this, you think, my God. But if you sort of work away at it, after you get a bit of exposure, you start to feel, oh, okay, these are quite nice. And it's kind of the same here, but I wouldn't expect you to think they're nice on the first exposure.
Marcus, so you've shown us a lot of really interesting stuff, and it might be a bit more than we can digest in one lecture. So if you want, we could set aside some time during one of the discussion sessions where you can show us some more of these.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's interested.
Okay.
I'll just tell you one nice thing. One nice thing. You take these things, so that defines a set of d squared 2d minus 2 dimensional hyperplanes in the big d squared dimensional space. And you can prove that if you take any two of these, they always intersect in a single line, exactly one line, no more, no less. I don't know. Chris and I got the idea there was some kind of polytope underneath all this. And I still think there might be. But it's very difficult to identify because, of course, these are actually quite low-dimensional objects. They're living in a d-squared dimensional space, and they're only 2d minus 2 dimensions. So you're not actually getting the faces, the d-squared minus 1 dimensional faces for the polytope. You are maybe getting some kind of skeleton, sort of lower dimensional edges or something. But there is I can say for certain is there's a great deal of structure here, an enormously rich structure, in fact. Probably much more than we've actually identified. So what we did was we investigated numerically, we found lots of nice things, and then we sat down and proved them. But of course, with that sort of approach, you have to ask the right questions. You have to think, well, maybe that would be a nice object to look at. And it could well be things we haven't asked. How useful it is to proving seek existence or understanding, I don't know.